Good morning. Thank you for having me. I also say Shabbat Tov and Chodesh Tov. As mentioned, I made Aliyah in 2007, trained as a psychologist in America. And since making Aliyah, I get a lot of questions from psychologists who want to make Aliyah or from students of mine who are interested in going into psychology. And one of the questions they ask me often is, how was the transition? How was it? Was it difficult to... I grew up in New Jersey. Was it difficult with the language? The truth is, as my Hebrew actually was not that bad. It has nothing to do with anything. When I was, I had this idea when I was living in New Jersey that I would speak to my kids only in Hebrew. I could be very stubborn, and so I was very strict. I only spoke to my kids in Hebrew, having nothing to do with Aliyah. I also highly recommend it. Just because I figured you can't really daven properly unless you know the words that you're saying. And when my wife would hand me an English book to read to them, I would read just translate it on the fly in Hebrew, which became very difficult for Dr. Seuss. But I learned all kinds of fascinating, you know, vocabulary words. But the it turns out that language was not the hardest transition. The hardest transition to being a psychologist in Israel really was culture. I made Aliyah at age 32, and after living in New Jersey for most of 32 years, the transition to an Israeli culture was hard. As a psychologist, you encounter different people and from all different walks of life, and you have to get to relate to them on their level. And I never did things like the Bagriot, or I never served in the army. I joke around that I was so old when I made Aliyah at 32. I guess doesn't sound old, but I was so old I didn't even merit postage. Like, the army didn't even send me a letter saying, you know, no thank you. Apparently, if you're a father of two and age 32, that it's just, you're like, eh. Okay, I got over that. But in any event, things like this, serving in the army, Bagriot, Tnuot Noar. I remember, I'll get mentioned later, I worked in an organization called Zichron Menachem for children with cancer. And going to these retreats and summer camps with these sick kids and all of the counselors. And people would just get up on tables and start cheering and singing. And yeah, okay, I had done NCSY, but I really felt I had not made Aliyah. I had landed on Mars. And it was just a different... I was like, oh, what is going on? This transition to this new kind of life was very difficult. One of the... and I've adapted. I still don't jump on tables. That is not highly recommended. One of the things that the differences in culture that I noticed the most, which I do think is positive, and that's what I'd like to talk about today, is the presence of a Kadosh Baruch Hu, of God, of Hashem, in everyday life in Israel. And I'm not talking about religious life. The fact that God's present in the shul, president of the shul, excuse me, that'd be really good.
He is president.
Yeah, well... That's right. That's the real president, capital P. So the God is present in everyday life, not just religious life, but even secular life in Israel, was something that I had really not expected before I made Aliyah. And I think it's really an amazing, beautiful thing. And that's what I'd like to discuss today and try to end off with what could be the message for those who are not in Eretz Israel, or in Chicago, for example. What would that be? I'd like to start with a sports story, or perhaps two. I grew up as a big sports fan, NBA, NFL, and when I made Aliyah, I heard the following story. It really struck a chord that in 1996, on Hanukkah, Maccabi Tel Aviv, which is like the, I'm not sure what like the opposite of the Cubs is, but like they won almost every year, right? Almost every year. Right. So they won almost every year, and in 1996, they went to play Greece. The Greek, I think Panthakios, my Greek's not so good, at Athens, they played them on Hanukkah 1996. Before the game, one of the players, they're not religious, gets up and lights the menorah, lights the Chanukiah on the stage, on the court, and says the bracha, the whole thing, before the game starts, as a way to sort of psych up the team that the again, Maccabi Tel Aviv is now going to defeat the Greeks. and they did. Again, it's a certain mindset that I don't think we have. Like these are not religious people, but that was normal. Another great story, this is from 2004, also Maccabi, sorry for the details for all the non-sports fans, but if you are, I think it's pretty cool. This was they were playing. This was in Israel. Maccabi Tel Aviv was playing Zalgiris, was a team from Kovno. We don't really think of Kovno from a sports perspective usually, but they were down 3 points with 2.2 seconds left. And the other team, and they fouled this guy on the other team, a guy named Gidras Gustas, I had to look this up, with 2.2 seconds left. This guy, okay, so now you had not missed a foul shot all season. He was 100% from the line for the year. Okay, this is basically, unless some guy from the stands grabs the ball, it's like impossible to lose at this point. I mean, for them. What happened was the guy, even though he had not missed a shot all season, he missed both foul shots, and with only 2.2 seconds left, the other team violated, they jumped over the line, so the Maccabi got the ball taken out from the side with 2.2 seconds left. A long pass, a guy hit a three with no time left, a guy named Derek Sharp, with no time left at the buzzer, and then Maccabi blew them out in overtime. All right, incredible. This is known in Israeli sports history as Nes Zalgiris. Right? Take this further. The you can look this up. The headline in the paper the next day was Yesh Elokim. Right. Except they didn't use a kuf. They actually said, I'm not going to, we'll get back to that later. Right. What I find... I find incredible is not just that they won, which, by the way, really was pretty incredible. The Vegas odds on that had to be really long. But I find incredible is that this is just a normal part of the culture. God is a part of the everyday conversation. When I'm not playing basketball, I try to work as a psychologist or a teacher. Basketball doesn't pay as well, I guess, for me. And I work with an organization, I said, called Zichron Menachem, and we like to take... children with cancer to different retreats. And one of the things that I do also is I run a group for the parents of these sick kids. One of the parents in one of my groups told me the following story, that after his son was diagnosed, son was, I think, 18 at the time, he was having a very difficult time. He had a very difficult kind of cancer. And he spoke to a Haredi fellow from Bnei Brak. He was speaking to one of his rebbeim, who told him the following story: that the Rebbe of Zvil, right, said the following analogy, the following parable: when a poor man comes to the door and asks for tzedakah, right, if the rich man actually gives him money, right, the larger the coin or the amount, the denomination that the rich man gives the poor man at the door, right, the more he gives him, the poor man understands that what he's doing is he's giving him change. And what he really wants is he's expecting to, the poor man gives the rich man a certain amount, says, hey, do you have a 10? It's because the rich man wants to give him 100. Right? If he asks the poor man for, hey, do you have a $100 bill? Right? It's because the rich man wants to give the poor man back an even greater sum of money. And he said, this helped him. He says that when God gives you a difficulty, very hard thing, cancer, sometimes a really difficult cancer, and his son, unfortunately, is still sick. It's a very hard case. Is the more that God gives you, that's only he's giving you change, right? What he really wants to do is he's going to give you the reward is even greater. And the story they tell is something we say in Pirkei Avot Zimra every morning is Mashlich Karcho Kefitim Lifnei Karato Miamod, or Kfor Ke'efer. Kfor Ke'efer Yefazer. I guess is an appropriate metaphor for Chicago. The explanation which he said, I think he said from the Imre Emet, that that God distributes, what does it mean God distributes frost like ashes? So the answer is because in measure with how much frost there is, that's how much ashes or how much ability God gives you in your furnace to be able to heat it up, right? I can heat up my furnace in order to deal with the frost. Or the same thing, right? What does it mean the snow is distributed like wool? Again, the pshat is certainly that the snow is white and soft and like wool. But the parable there is that God gives a person wool in accordance with the cold that's about to come, right? And this idea that a lot of the sick people that I work with is that they believe that whatever God gives you, he's only giving to you because you can handle it. And if he gives you something difficult, he's already given you the wool coat that you'll need in order to be able to handle the cold weather. And this is what this man had said. One of the Chiloni people in the group turns around and says, you may look at me and say that I'm secular, I'm not observant, and think that the emuna and faith is not a part of the way that I deal with it. But you should just know that if not for my faith in Kadosh Baruch Hu, not for my bitachon, I never would have been able to survive the cancer that my daughter is going through. And this was just one example among many, that this idea of having run many of these groups and spoken to many individuals, faith and bitachon and emunah and seeing Yad Hashem is something that's not exclusive to the religious community. Right? That's easy. But something even in the secular community is something that I see all the time. It's everyone there has a relationship with the Kadosh Baruch Hu. In some respect, it's part of the conversation, not just the headline of the paper. It's part of the everyday conversation. There's an unusual mitzvah of the Torah. Pasuk's in Devarim. It says, Et Hashem Elokecha tira, oto ta'avod avot tidbak. We're supposed to fear God, to serve Him, and have dveikus, to cling to Kadosh Baruch Hu. The end of that pasuk is, lesser known, it says, Uvishmo tishaveya, which means it's a mitzvah to swear in the name of Kadosh Baruch Hu. This sounds very in contrast to how we're taught. We're always taught that you should always say, bli neder, if you learn the Gemaras and the Shulchan Aruch, always we try to avoid taking a shvua. Some people would rather, even in court, rather pay money than have to pull a Sefer Torah out and hold it and take a shvua, right? Why would there, it sounds like there's a mitzvah on the Torah of Ushmo Tishaveya. I'd like to suggest that actually there's another mitzvah in the Torah, which is, this is in Sefer Shmot, that really is in contrast to this. This is the mitzvah, is V'shem Elohim Acherim Lo Tazkiru. You're not allowed to mention the names of other gods. Lo Yishama Al Picha. Right? We're not allowed to have the names of other gods in our tongues. Chazal say this idea here is that even if it's giving someone directions, right? I don't know what the waves was like back then, but if you say, like, hey, how do you get to the airport? So go down there and make a left at the statue of, whatever. And that has nothing to do. I'm not asking the person to worship whatever false deity we're talking about. But even to mention the names of idols is somehow problematic. I would suggest that these two mitzvahs are the positive commandment and the negative one are really in foils. One's in contrast to the other one. Just like we're not supposed to mention even idolatry or false gods, in some respect, perhaps there is a positive aspect to having God on our lips, having God's names on our tongues. In fact, the Sefer Chinuch on this mitzvah, Shmo Tishaveh, says as follows. He says, Mishar She Mitzvah, what's the behind the mitzvah? Kibyoteinu Mekimim Dvarenu Bishmo HaGadol, when we invoke God's name in our speech, in this case perhaps to take an oath, Titchazek B'libeinu HaEmunah Bo, that our faith in Kadosh Baruch Hu will be strengthened. V'hashkachato Aleinu V'al Kol Dvarenu. It's clear that the more that we have God on our tongues, we mention His name, we use His we invoke His name in our speech, the more our emunah is strengthened, the more we see Him as a part of our everyday life. Yes, one can take it too far. Right? If we think of God literally on our mouths all the time, then maybe we should say Yesh Elokim when we publish in the paper. Maybe people sometimes should be careful where they invoke God's name. Right? We can take that too far, but like everything, there's a positive way to do it, and we should have that, try to strike that that positive balance. I think it's nice that Rabbi Blatt pointed out that in some ways in Israel, there's a greater integration of all these different things. In America, I guess, I felt that sometimes life was too bifurcated. It's too divided, like there's these mechitzot, these iron walls we tend to put up, that like there's the God and the shul, the Beit Midrash, and then there's outside. I remember once my wife and I went, we like going whitewater rafting. So on our honeymoon, we were in a whitewater rafting trip and we got down to the Rio Grande in Taos, and the rafting guide, who actually, I think technically did qualify as an Ovid of Odazara, that's not a metaphor, we actually worship the Red Hawk idol, apparently. So he says, he sees my wife in a skirt and says, why are you doing this? She says, well, it's religious modesty purposes. There's no place for religion down on the river. In other words, it's not, somehow like that's constricted, but you hear that there's no place for that. That's in terms of speech. I think in terms of practice, we see this also. There is the famous Pew study that came out of, I think it's been released in bits and pieces over the past 10 years, that looked at religious, they looked at religious belief, they looked at many different things, also they looked at religious practice. They looked at, how many the different practices are very compared also America and Israel. They did find is that Israelis tend to engage in religious practice more than Americans. Now, this. My background is in statistics also. Part of that is explainable by the fact that there's more religious Jews in Israel than there are in, or percentage-wise, than there are in America. It turns out that about 10% of American Jews are religious, or observant, compared to 22% of Israeli Jews. But that does not explain all of the data. I'll share with you some of the data. 63% of Israeli Jews keep kosher at home at some level, in comparison to 22% in the U.S. Only 55% of Israelis will handle money on Shabbos, compared to 85% of American Jews. 56% of Israeli Jews light candles on Shabbos, compared to 23% of American Jews. A whopping 60% of Israeli Jews fasted all day in Yom Kippur, compared to 40% of American Jews. Just two more. It's interesting. There are 16% of Israelis who would eat pork, compared to 57% of American Jews. And percent. This is really fascinating. What percentage of Israeli Jews participate in a Seder? So that number is 93% of Israelis had a Seder last year, compared to 70% of Americans. Again, this is not only explainable by how many Jews are religious. Take it further, I thought this is striking. If you look only at Chilonim, right? People who self-identify as being secular, 87% of them went to a Seder last year. That was pretty incredible. 33% of secular Jews, say they keep kosher at home at some level, 33%. And 30% of secular Jews fasted all day on Yom Kippur. Right? Now, even the secular Jews in the study, they asked them to identify if they, I don't know what exactly they called this, if they were identified as secular, regular secular Jews or secular anti-religious Jews. Okay. I call that frum chilonim. Like they're chilonim, but they're really, really careful, really strict about it. That's all of them. And I have to believe that if you take out what I've called these frum chilonim, if you take them out of it, that those numbers go up even higher. Right? That's incredible. Right? And in some respect, this even religious practice has become a part of everyday life. I remember I was so struck, it's a silly example perhaps, when I bought eggs on Pesach, even on the egg was printed Chag Sameach. And I remember the first time I'm thinking, like even the chickens know. Like, how, incredible thing. You know? And like something like Shavuot, I mean, it's such a, like a what percent, I didn't see the data. What percentage of American Jews have even heard of the Feast of Weeks of Shavuot? I mean, in Israel, everybody has. Like, there are the sales on dairy products in the stores. I mean, along with recipes, and it's incredible. Actually, in the secular kibbutzim, it's the main mitzvah on Shavuot is not staying up and learning all night, it's the Bikurim. And they'll have these processions with tractors and probably on Yantif, okay, whatever. And they'll have the kids born, and it's this tremendous procession they have on Shavuot. Is this good or bad? So when Ezra rebuilt the second Beit HaMikdash, the pasuk in Ezra is as follows: Vayisdu abonim et heichal Hashem, vayamidu akonim melubashim chatzotzot. Right? They had a pomp and circumstance, and the Levim and the Kohanim, and they sang Hallel, right? Hallel et Hashem al yedei David melech Yisrael. They sang just like we did this morning, they sang Hallel. Reinu b'Hallel v'hodot l'Hashem ki tov ki l'olam chasdo. Right? Wonderful. Right? They rebuilt and made them just say, Hodot l'Hashem ki tov ki l'olam chasdo. They blew the shofar. Right, Al Husad Beit Hashem, and then the rededication and the founding of the laying the foundation of the new Beit Hamikdash. Rabim me'akohen v'alavim rashi avot azkenim asher ra'u et ha'bayit harishon. Many of the older generation who had seen the first Beit Hamikdash, because those zehabayit, when they were laying the foundation for the second Beit Hamikdash, abeinehem bochim b'kol gadol, they were crying. Rabim b'tru'a b'simcha laharim kol. And many people were shouting and exulting, blowing the shofar. The pasuk tells us that Eina Am Akim Kol Chuar Basimcha LaKol Bechi Ha'am, and they couldn't tell the difference between the shofar and the rejoicing and the crying. Ki Amirim Chuag Dolava Kol Nishma Ad Merachok. It was so noisy, it was so much singing and dancing, but also crying. It sort of was hard to distinguish between the two. Why were they crying? I'm sure there are many different explanations, but I believe that one of them is as follows, that you know, they see the rebuilding of the Beit HaMikdash, and hopefully we will merit to see that also, right? Some of the older generation probably looked at the second Beit HaMikdash, not the one that Hordus that's more famous, but the original, which was kind of shvach. It was nothing to write home to Bavel about, right? It was nothing, it was very meager, and they probably looked back to what they had remembered, you know, when they were kids, at the glorious first Beit HaMikdash, and they looked at this as like, and they were, oh, it's, I can't, like, this is what we get, like, this is, and they were sad, it's disappointing. And some of the younger generation probably looked at it and said, this is unbelievable, right? We grew up in Bavel, right? We were in Galus and oppressed, and now with Beit HaMikdash, it's fantastic, right? And they were rejoicing. You could have people looking at the same thing, and one could be sad and one could be happy. And I think that's the way we look at some of these things, that you know, the why is, you know, even secular Zionists and even secular Jews in Israel, all these different things are celebrating Shavuos on some level and fasting Yom Kippur and having a Bris Milah and a Pesach Seder, is that a good thing or a bad thing? There are people who look at that and say it's very negative. They've taken all the holiness out of it. They've taken this most holy mitzvahs, right? Brit Milah and Pesach and Yom Kippur. And they're doing it because it's cultural. They're doing it because this is what everybody does. They're doing it because they're... It's become like a national institution, right? There's no holiness to it. And look at that as a negative, right? And they cry. I personally look at that as a very positive thing. I think it's that this has become part of identity. It's become so ingrained that this is part of what it is to be a Jew in Eretz Yisrael. Right? When Yonah is asked who he is, he says, Ivri Anochi. He says, I'm a Jew, I'm a Hebrew, right? Whereas Moshe, when he saves the daughters of Yitro, right? They describe him to their father as an Ish Mitzri, right? Moshe was the best, the greatest of all time, the goat, right? But when we look at ourselves and in Israel, we said that's part of our identity. It's almost become part of what it means to be an Israeli, part of a Jew. It's like these things are a very part of our nature. And the same study, they asked American Jews, what does it mean to be a Jew? And they said things like remembering the Holocaust, eating traditional foods, having a good sense of humor. Like, these are the things that a lot of the American Jews said what it meant to be Jewish in America. I think this, again, less relevant for us in this room, but for the vast majority of the other 90% of Jews in America who are not religious, this is what they felt meant to be a Jew. And I think in Israel, it's really not the case. And I personally look at this as a very positive thing. What is it about, in closing, what is it about living in Israel that leads to this phenomenon? I'll give three answers. One is mystical, which I don't really understand, but I'll say it. And the second one, more traditionally Jewish. And the third one, I guess since I'm a psychologist, I'll give the rationalist psychology answer. Rabbi Yehuda Levi, the Kuzari, was of the opinion that the environmental conditions of Eretz Yisrael actually lead to somehow to the production of Nevi'im, to prophecy. He says, it's not his examples, but it's just like, you know, the soil in Colombia and Ethiopia is particularly suited to producing coffee. And the hills of France are particularly suited to the production of wine. Somehow the environmental conditions in Eretz Yisrael are particularly suited to the production of prophets, to connecting with a Kaddish Baruch Hu. And in fact, I think that's perhaps even reflected in this week's parsha, and even what we read yesterday, that if you don't keep a certain amount of Eretz Yisrael, the land itself, if you don't keep a Torah, the land itself will spew you out. To the point that even in times of the Samaritans were put there, and they were... Even they were overrun by lions because they were they were worshiping idols. That's his answer. The Ramban, in his famous Rosh Hashanah drasha that he gave in Eretz Yisrael at the end of his life, says that really what represented to him Eretz Yisrael was that it was the house of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, not just the Beit HaMikdash, right? But even all of Eretz Yisrael, he calls Nachalat Hashem. That living in Eretz Yisrael means you're living in God's house. And based on the famous Zohar, he said that in every other land, God runs it through intermediaries. Right? But in God's own house, in his backyard, in Nachalat Hashem, he runs it directly. He doesn't outsource that. He runs in a much more direct fashion. And that, I think, is what it's like to live in Eretz Yisrael, living in God's house, in his backyard. Right? The Ramban felt that he, as part of his, he gives mussar to the people listening to his drasha about how they need to conduct themselves. And that's really what it's like to living in Eretz Yisrael. I guess in closing, I think in a much more rationalist perspective, one could say that if we put this all together and give a third reason, which is that in some respects, living in Eretz Yisrael in this environment in God's house, but in the fact also that it's a country that we run, it's not just Eretz Yisrael, it's Medina Yisrael. So we've come to merit in the past 71 years is that we run the show, right? It's our ship. We're in charge. And it's a country where it's kind of cool that you can actually write the Hebrew date on a check. I had a harder time cashing one of those scanning it on my iPhone, but the law in Israel is you can actually write that today is Lama Nisan, which is pretty cool, right? Growing up in New Jersey, I remember that there's certain parts of religious practice that were uncomfortable. I never forget that. I used to walk this long walk past Highland Park High School in Highland Park, New Jersey, and on Sukkot, on the first day of Sukkot, walking past the high school with my long palm frond and lemon and walking past all these open windows of the high school, feeling like so uncomfortable. And ironically, when I was in shul in New Jersey on Friday, the rabbi in his 5-minute halacha talk after davening said that the Mishnah Berurah says that the real halacha is that you should be putting on tefillin as soon as you wake up in the morning, right? Then go to shul, walk wearing your tefillin. You should never be putting on your tefillin in shul. You should putting them at home and walking, going to shul wearing your tefillin. Growing up in New Jersey, I imagine it was the same here. What people would think I was like a unicorn, or maybe that would justify Michelangelo. This is bizarre, right? But in Eretz Yisrael, I remember in Beit Shemesh, I've seen people like they drive to shul with their tefillin on. And even for me, having grown up in America, I still can't get a handle on that. But my son, who's 13, who moved to Israel when he was 1.5, can't fathom the fact that someone would walk around without their tzitzis tucked out. That's the normal there. And a certain ability to, that there's no shame. It's just part of what everybody does. And it's part of, it's much more integrated. It allows you to be a Jew in the fullest sense. I think it's part of the thing that's nice about living in Eretz Yisrael. Look, like everything, there's a downside. I think that if you grow up living in God's house, and this is my house, and it's how I live, then in some respects, when you don't know what it's like to live in someone else's house. And like I said, these camps that I go on, where we take 200 Israelis and bring them to Europe, sometimes the Israeli culture and the Dutch culture, for example, they don't seem to mend very well. Israeli is sort of, again, you live by sometimes no rules, and the Dutch... live very, what the Israelis would call, they're very mirubah, they're very, square and rule-following, but in a more passive way. Like, the Israelis would just go crazy and do whatever they're doing, and the Dutch will just sort of, get very irritated, but look askance, and that's about the extent of how they get irritated about it. But it used to really irritate me. I said, how can you guys not understand? It's Techil Hashem, you're defaming God's name. And I realized that it's, again, I don't think this is positive, but when you grow up, that this is your house, you don't know what it's like to live in someone else's house. That's, I guess, the downside. I've tried to help them bring that. What does this all mean for us? This will close. This is not an Aliyah speech. I'm not trying to convince you that Israel's awesome and that you should move. I'll leave that unsaid. We're looking for good neighbors. But I think definitely it's Eizu Chacham Halomed Mikol Adam. And I think that as religious Jews, even living in America, what can we learn from this? I think we can certainly learn that there's a certain kind of, bifurcation that we have in Chutz La'aretz, that we don't tend to live as integrated a life as perhaps is possible in Eretz Yisrael. Do we live as, is God found on our lips, heard on our lips all throughout the day that we sing Bezrat Hashem and in Yirtz Hashem? Are we seeing the Yad Hashem in everything that we do? Are we living religiously all throughout our lives? And I think this is really best said by the Rambam. If you haven't seen this, this is the Rambam, the end of third parak of Hilchot Deot. The Rambam says that you should have God as part of everything that you do. And he says, Nimtza Malech Baderach Zo Kol Yomav, Ovedet Hashem Tamid. If you can bring God into every aspect of your life, then you're really constantly serving Kadosh Baruch Hu. Afilu, let's just give some of his examples. Afilu B'Shah Shenoseh V'Notein. Even when you're doing business, right? If when you're in business, if you're trying to make money in order to provide for your family, in order to spend your kids to a Jewish education, right? Then even at work, that's called Avodat Hashem. If you're sleeping in order that you should rest and recharge yourself so that you can serve God in the morning, Nimtei sheina shelo avodat lamakom baruch hu. Even you're sleeping, that's called avodat Hashem. Va'al inyan zeh tivuch hachamim v'amru v'chol ma'aseh chayu shel shamayim. This is what Chazal meant when they said that everything you do should be for the service or sake of heaven. V'hu shamar shalom b'chokhmato v'chol derachecha da'ehu v'hu yiyasher ochotecha. Right, famous idea. V'chol derachecha da'ehu. You should know God in everything that you do. And I think this is easier when you're living in God's house. It's easier when you're living in God's backyard to feel and see and serve God in everything that you do. But I think it's possible to bring some of that, whether to even to Chicago and wherever you may be in around the world. And I guess my bracha to you is that if we're able to do this and achieve b'chol derechecha de'ehu, even in here in faraway Chicago, we should be merit the brachas. You should merit to also have the end of that pasuk, which is v'hu yasher orchotecha, which the Malbim and others explain, mean that if you can bring God and see God in everything that you do, b'chol derechecha, and He will come and He will straighten out your paths. He'll give you the wisdom to succeed in all of your endeavors. And b'hu yasher orchotecha. Thank you very much for having me, and hope you have a good show. Yeah.